This is Carol Bond, returning with the September 1st issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll continue now with an article by Huey Freeman, headlined "Dual Fatality Crash Cause Still Unclear." An accident that took the lives of two men and resulted in a fire that made it difficult to identify the victims was the result of one driver crossing the center lane and driving head-on into the other. Macon County Sheriff's Deputy Matthew Jedlicka testified Monday at the coroner's inquest that John Franklin, 22, of Lincoln, was driving east on Illinois 121 in a 2007 Chevrolet HHR when his car entered the westbound lane and crashed into a Chevrolet pickup truck driven by Robert K. Doty at about 11 a.m. July 7th. The fire that erupted, likely the result of a full 80-gallon diesel tank carried in the truck's bed, could have eliminated evidence of why Franklin's vehicle went off course. Franklin was on his way to work in Decatur, while Doty, a truck driver who was pulling a flatbed trailer, was on a work-related run. There had been light rain in the area on an overcast day, but there were no visibility or road conditions that contributed to the accident, Jedlicka testified. Both vehicles were traveling at about 55 miles per hour, according to witnesses. When Macon County Coroner Michael Day asked Jedlicka why Franklin crossed the center line, he responded, quote, "Reasons are unknown at this point." When the vehicles collided near the intersection of Lincoln Memorial Parkway, 2 miles northwest of Warrensburg, they spun around and stopped. A small fire ignited in the rear passenger compartment of the pickup truck. The blaze erupted quickly, witnesses told first responders. Flames engulfed both vehicles, consuming everything inside them. All that remained of the vehicles was, quote, "bare metal and wire," Jedlicka testified. Investigators began searching for clues on the victims' identities. A license plate that fell off the passenger car was traced to a Lincoln address, leading to the identification of the younger man. A vehicle identification number was located on the pickup truck with the help of a Chevrolet dealership. The vehicle was registered to a company in Oklahoma, which identified the assigned driver as Doty, a Decatur resident. An autopsy of Franklin showed that his death was caused by multiple blunt force injuries due to a vehicle collision, Day said. A toxicology report showed that he had not used narcotics or alcohol. The results of Robert Doty's autopsy were surprising. The coroner's physician ruled that he died as a result of cardiovascular disease that led to a heart attack. It was not possible to pinpoint the time of the heart attack, but it is believed it was triggered by the impact or impending impact. The coroner's jury ruled Doty's death as undetermined, Franklin's death as accidental. Here's an article, Dateline Chicago, and written by Edith Brady Lunny of the Lee News Service, but it has a connection to our area. The headline is "Clinton Lake Deaths Loom in Custody Fight." The fight by a former Clinton woman and her husband to regain custody of her three children did not begin in 2014, when the state took the children, or in 2006, when she was convicted of child endangerment in the drowning deaths of her first three children, a prosecutor told a Cook County juvenile court judge Monday. For Amanda Ware, known as Amanda Hamm, when her first three children drowned in Clinton Lake in 2003, the path to the Chicago courtroom started in 1995 when she allegedly disclosed plans to kill herself by drowning in a lake. Cook County Assistant State's Attorney Joan Pernecki said in opening statements. Amanda Ware and her husband Leo have been embroiled in a custody battle with the State Department of Children and Family Services since March 2014, when their newborn son and two young daughters were removed from their care. The boy, now 18 months old, and his sisters, ages 5 and 3, have been living with Leo Ware's sister on Chicago's South Side. Cook County Associate Judge Demetrios G. Kataris heard testimony in the custody dispute that is on track to be a replay of significant portions of Ware's 2006 trial, in which she was acquitted of murder but convicted of child endangerment related to the drowning deaths of her children. Pernecki claims Ware's 1995 hospitalization for mental health issues when she was 19 was the basis for the 2003 deaths. The suicide plans were meant for Ware, but later served as the groundwork for the children's deaths, said the prosecutor. Lisa Dedman, the lawyer for Leo Ware, argued the Wares entered the child welfare system in 2014 only because a doctor recognized Ware as the woman in the 2003 drowning case. Quote, "There were no signs of abuse or neglect of the children," unquote, when a DCFS investigator went to the home on March 1, 2014, and removed the two girls in an emotional struggle with the children who fought efforts to take them, Dedman said. The state argues the Wares both have histories of substance abuse and criminal convictions. Amanda Ware has been a victim of physical and sexual abuse, and she once sought and then dropped an order of protection against her husband after an argument, according to the state. The history of mistakes by the pair represents, quote, "a freight train of evidence bearing down," said the prosecutor. Referring to the three surviving children, the prosecutor said, "We can't let them follow in the fate of their three older siblings." Mary Carroll, the DCFS investigator sent to check the Ware home after a hotline complaint was made in March 2014, testified that the home was clean and her interview with the oldest daughter produced no concerns of abuse. Amanda Ware sat in the courtroom behind the table where her husband and their lawyer sat, surrounded by boxes of documents, many of them from the DeWitt County murder cases. The trial will continue today, with the state expected to call law enforcement officers from the 2003 case. Members of Amanda Ware's family are among witnesses expected to testify on her behalf next week. Prosecutors intend to call witnesses several law enforcement officers who were among the first responders to Clinton Lake on September 2, 2003, after Ware called 911 to report that her car had gone into the water with Christopher Ham, 6, Austin Brown, 3, and Kylie, 23 months, in the back seat. Maurice Legrone, her boyfriend at the time of the 2003 drownings, was convicted of murder and is serving life in prison. She was sentenced to 10 years, but with credit for time served in the jail, awaiting trial, and good conduct credit from the Department of Corrections, she was behind bars for about 5 years. The Wares live in Chicago, where they met and married after her 2008 release from prison. She served about 14 months on the child endangerment charges. According to Amanda Ware, her parole officer was aware that she was pregnant and visited her with her first child. She contends that paperwork from the DCFS notifying her that she was on a registry of known child abusers never came to her during her incarceration. She remains on the list for 50 years. Both Wares have been required to complete counseling and psychological evaluations since 2014. Let's turn now to find out what the writers to Dear Abby are asking today. Dear Kathy, sorry, that's the response. Let me try again. Dear Abby, I was best friends with Joanne after we met in middle school. She comes from a conservative Christian family and has 3 successful siblings. This has made her quirky, media-driven pursuits and city life a disappointment to her family. When we were teens and she learned that I was a straight ally for gay rights, she came out to me as a lesbian, but for years only I and a few close friends knew. Once she was an adult and her family found out, they practically disowned her and made their disapproval and shame very clear. Unfortunately, due to some family problems of my own, I moved away, and we communicated only periodically for the last couple of years, until recently I was shocked when she informed me that she's going to become a nun. Abby, I have no problem with her faith. I attend an LGBT-friendly church, but am afraid Joanne is doing it for all the wrong reasons. For the 15 years I have known her, she has been an open-minded, culture-loving, social butterfly, and she doesn't seem to have changed much personality-wise. Naturally, her family is thrilled with her decision because it means she will never date another woman or be a part of that lifestyle. I know Joanne is an adult and these choices are hers to make, but I'm afraid she is being guilted into a life she will ultimately regret. How do I express my concerns to her without being offensive? Signed, Kathy in New York. Dear Kathy, before you express your concerns, I think you should have enough respect for your friend's intelligence to ask her what has prompted this life-changing decision and what it will entail. Will she be joining an order that wears a habit? Not all nuns do anymore. Will she be taking a vow of silence and shutting herself off from the world for a life of prayer and contemplation? Or will she be working to help underprivileged communities? Does she plan to remain in the U.S. or join an order like Mother Teresa's in some other country? If you show an interest rather than concern, I'm sure she will be glad to answer any questions you may have without becoming offended. This is another letter from Nathan in Indiana. Dear Abby, I have recently been invited to my sister's baby shower. The problem is I am a man. My mother and sister think I am sexist for not wanting to go. I always thought this kind of thing was a women's event. Are my mother and sister right? Am I being sexist? Dear Nathan, you're not necessarily sexist, but you are behind the times. baby showers are no longer solely women's events. In fact, because men are so much more actively involved in their little ones' care than they used to be, it is becoming a common thing for the showers to be co-ed affairs. They're called Jack and Jill showers. I hope you won't skip the celebration, because I think you'd enjoy it. On the editorial page, there's this editorial having to do with University of Illinois sport. The headline is, "No Soft Landing for Beckman." The firing of Tim Beckman as the University of Illinois football coach on Friday was significant for a lot of reasons, including that the university finally took a stand against an employee who apparently hadn't performed to standards. The university is conducting an investigation into allegations by a former player that he was forced to play while injured. The investigation hasn't been completed, but athletics director Mike Thomas had apparently learned enough by Friday morning. He said that Beckman had mishandled injuries and that he attempted to force players off scholarship before graduation. Beckman denies both allegations and indicated in a statement that he might sue the university. So there may be more to say about his dismissal at a later date. Many are wondering about the effect this will have on the team, which opens its season on Friday. We'll let the fans and sports pundits sort that one out. However, what was important about the dismissal was that Beckman wasn't offered any sort of soft landing. Thomas made it clear that Beckman will not receive the $3.1 million remaining on the last 2 years of his contract. The university also won't pay him the $743,000 that was called for if his contract was bought out. That contrasts dramatically with the deal the university made with Phyllis Wise, the departing chancellor. Wise, who conducted some of the university's business via her private email account in violation of university policy, was offered a $300,000 teaching position, a year's sabbatical, and $400,000 of her $500,000 retention bonus. Fortunately, the Board of Trustees stepped in and nixed the deal. Or take the case of College of DuPage President Robert Broder, who is being paid $763,000 to leave next March. A new board has instead taken steps to fire him. We may never know for sure, but one has to assume that the university didn't want to offer a golden parachute to another high-profile university employee who had violated university standards. That's the way it should be. Highly paid public employees shouldn't be rewarded financially for performing poorly. If the allegations against Beckman are true, he certainly shouldn't be rewarded. Athletic coaches must put the well-being of their athletes ahead of all else. Football coaches are paid exceedingly well and are expected to win, but they are also expected to represent their university in a positive manner. Mistreating people is rarely the road to success. In the same vein, the university needs to respect the money that taxpayers, students, parents, and donors pour into the institution. That includes not rewarding generous payouts to employees who have failed to perform their jobs adequately. And this is a copyright editorial by the Herald and Review. Dick Saker, H&R Senior Copy Editor, has a quiz today, and the title is A State by Any Other Name. He gives a series of states, and then he gives nicknames that he wants us to match. So I'll read the names of the states first, and then I'll read the answers. Sunshine State. That's number one. Number two, the Beehive State. Number three, the Sunflower State. Number four, the Last Frontier. Five, Land of 10,000 Lakes. Six, Land of Enchantment. Seven, the Sooner State. Eight, Golden State. And here are the choices. New Mexico, Florida, Oklahoma, Minnesota, California, Utah, Alaska, and Kansas. Take a moment or two to think about that. He says, by the way, Illinois was widely known as the Sucker State in the 1800s, and he says, parenthetically, insert your own joke. Besides Land of Lincoln, the state has an unofficial nickname as the Prairie State. All right, here are the answers. The Sunshine State is Florida. The Sunflower State is Kansas. The Last Frontier is Alaska. The Land of 10,000 Lakes is Minnesota. The Land of Enchantment, New Mexico. The Sooner State, Oklahoma. And Golden State is California. On the entertainment page, we read Tim Kaine's blog about Melody Patterson, and Tim is the H&R Entertainment editor. One of the interesting things about learning via social media of the deaths of celebrities and other notable people is the deaths that pass you by. Horror film director Wes Craven was suitably mourned by people in my social media feed. The death of neurologist author Oliver Sacks, while not overwhelmingly so, was represented well to me in all sorts of input. So how is it that the death of Melody Patterson, best known as Wrangler Jane in the two-season 1960s comedy F Troop, passed so many people by? F Troop is one of those shows that doesn't really exist anymore. It was a dumb show. Even its biggest fans will admit that, while simultaneously professing their undying love for it. Its syndication presence was such that even if you're as young as 30, thanks to Nick at Night, you know all the folks from Fort Courage. And you probably also remember the nonstop use of that now insensitive name used, among other places, by the Washington, D.C. NFL team. In a perfect world, Patterson would have been mourned the way Yvonne Batgirl Craig was after her death earlier this summer. But in a perfect world, Patterson wouldn't have suffered a broken back and battled illnesses at the end of her life either. Me, I remember her from F Troop, sure. But she was great in the episode of The Monkees in which she appeared. A couple of kind souls have been thoughtful and put it on YouTube. If you can check it out, I advise it. It's very fun. We turn now to the Decatur Tribune and see what Paul Osborne is saying in his City Beat. The headline is, "Some people pay no attention to rules on, quote, appearance of citizens at council meetings." Among the last items on the agenda for a regular city council meeting is the appearance of citizens. This is the opportunity for citizens to stand before the council and express their feelings on a subject connected to the city. Before that part of the meeting is open for citizens' comments, the mayor reads the following statement of policy regarding the appearance of citizens. And this is a quotation. A 15-minute time period is provided for citizens to appear and express their views before the City Council. Each citizen who appears will be limited to 3 minutes. No immediate response will be given by City Council or City staff members. Citizens are to give their documents to the police officer for distribution to the Council. End quote. It is important to remember that during the appearance of citizens, the only communication between the person addressing the council and the council comes from the mayor, who asks the person's identity at the beginning of the session and thanks the person for addressing the council when that person is finished. Members of the council, along with staff members, are to listen and not let the person engage them in conversation or debate. It is up to the mayor to allow a little more time than 3 minutes for someone addressing the council, or if there are a lot of people who want to address council that night, to extend the 15-minute time period for all comments. All the mayors over the years have shown sensitivity in allowing people to finish their comments unless the time greatly exceeds 3 minutes. Sometimes the appearance of citizens can become a platform for someone to grill city staff or council and demand answers to questions they ask during their 3 minutes of comments. Obviously, these people pay no attention to the rules that were read to them at the beginning of that part of the meeting. Appearance of citizens is the time for the council and staff to listen to the concerns of private citizens. During the years that I served as mayor, I can only remember one time when I stopped someone from continuing to speak for something other than seriously abusing the 3-minute rule or profanity. That was when the city of Decatur was negotiating a contract with a cable provider, and when the city's negotiating team asked for what was extremely reasonable, the company balked and sent one of its attorneys to negotiate directly with the city council and bypass those representing the council's legal interests. In my opinion, that was not legal, since it is illegal for the city council to directly negotiate such contracts. After he got started and it was apparent what he was trying to do, I told him why he couldn't keep talking, and he stepped back and sat down. You don't negotiate a contract under the appearance of citizens at a council meeting. You can't use freedom of speech to do what is highly inappropriate and sometimes illegal when it comes to public meetings. The next day, the daily newspaper frowned upon my action, indicating I had no right to cut the person off. Of course, I had every right, and that was the only time during all the years I served that I called the Daily about anything that was written about me. I explained the mayor, as chairman, runs the meeting and has the gavel, and has the right and responsibility to conduct the meeting with decorum. To its credit, the newspaper corrected what had been written. Paul Osborne has more to say on this subject, but it's a little lengthy. I will say that the remainder has to do with the requirement that people who are addressing the council should face the council and not turn their back to the council and speak to the audience. And evidently, that is something else that has been taking place recently. Paul Osborne wants to correct that. This has been Carol Bond reading the September 1st issue of the Decatur Herald and Review and also the Decatur Tribune. I look forward to reading with you again.